I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, in the early 1970s, the Houston neighborhood of the Heights was the hunting ground for one of the worst serial killers in Texas history. He was known as the Candy Man, but his name was Dean Corll. Aided by two teen accomplices, Corll preyed on young men and teens, luring them into his home where they were handcuffed, tortured, raped, and murdered. There were at least 28 victims, but many believe that number could be higher. There are still many unanswered questions and lessons that can be learned about Corll's crimes and his victims. Investigative journalist Lisa Olson has uncovered new information for her new book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Did you know that many employees qualify for a matching gift through their workplace? Getting started is quick, easy, and can significantly boost your support for Texas Public Radio. Visit tpr.org/workplacegiving to see if your employer participates and maximize your impact today. Visit tpr.org/workplacegiving to see if your employer participates and maximize your impact today.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dean Corll was a serial killer who preyed on young, vulnerable men and teens in Houston from 1970 to 1973. There were about 30 victims, and at the time, police were completely unaware of Corll and his crimes. This was an age when it wasn't unusual for men to run away and start new lives elsewhere. At least that's what police told the concerned parents who came asking for help. Well, who were these young men that were killed and buried by Corll in a boat shed and other locations around Houston? One unrelenting forensic anthropologist decided to find out. Investigative journalist Lisa Olson tells that story in her new book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. And Lisa Olson, welcome back to The Source.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Glad to be here.
Lisa, you made a deliberate choice, it seems, to focus on this forensic scientist who decided to track down the trails that many people had forgotten about. You're not focusing on the serial killer. You're looking at the people who are trying to still solve this crime.
That's absolutely right. A lot of Texans remember this case, at least Texans of a certain age. And in fact, the major murder trial related to this case happened in Bexar County. So some people may remember that event. But at the time, police basically identified Dean Corll, the killer, who was murdered by one of his accomplices, killed by one of his accomplices, who then went to prison. His name was Elmer Wayne Henley, and they sometimes remember his other teenaged accomplice, David Brooks. Those two teenagers went to prison for killing what was thought originally to be 27 victims. In 1973, that made international news and really left a whole generation of Texans feeling uneasy about their lives, about being able to safely walk to the bowling alley, walk to a swimming alley, swimming pool, walk to or ride a bike to work. But the part that I'm telling, the story I'm telling, starts really in the 2000s when a woman who was a teenager in the 70s in Austin, Sharon Derrick, heard the story of these boys disappearing in Houston. And then years later, she becomes a forensic anthropologist and goes into the cold storage room at the Harris County morgue, Emmy's office, and discovers among over 100 sets of old remains, basically unidentified persons and unidentified bones, a mysterious box that says this 1973 mass murders. And she learns, to her surprise, that out of this infamous case from 1973, still 30, 40 years later, nearly a third of the victims remain unidentified. And it really shocks her because this case, Dean Corll kind of hunted and kidnapped and killed boys from a relatively small area in and around the Houston neighborhood called the Heights and other neighborhoods near there. And she knew that neighborhood. She thought, well, this is a neighborhood where a lot of people know each other. How can it be that even 30, 40 years later, these boys that have been missing since 1973 haven't been identified? So she decides to do something about it. And that's where the story starts. She makes these identifications. And as she does this, I argue that this becomes sort of a murder mystery in reverse, that we know who did it, but we don't know who he killed. And with each new identification, new information about these really infamous crimes comes to light that I would argue are still really relevant today in our society.
Our phone lines are open. If you want to call in, if you got a question, a comment, a memory about the Candyman serial killers, serial killings that happened in Houston, 7073, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Why do we call it the Candyman serial killer, and why didn't you use Candyman in your title of your book?
Well, the reason Dean Corll was called the Candyman was because he and his mother, Mary, operated a series of candy shops in the Houston Heights neighborhood, three different locations, all of them very near elementary schools. And at each of those locations, he befriended young boys, teenagers. He, particularly at the location that was right next to Helms Elementary School in Houston, he invited young kids to hang out after school, play pool, and some of those kids worked for him, sweeping the floor, delivering candy. Among those children were kids he later captured, tortured, and killed. And some of their parents knew and trusted him. In fact, some of the parents went to Corll when some of their children disappeared and asked them if he knew anything about where they'd gone or where they might have run away to, because police kept telling these parents their kids ran away. And of course, Corll said he didn't know. So that's why he's known as the Candyman. I didn't use the Candyman in the title because there was another infamous Texas case involving a man who poisoned Halloween candy, who also is often called the Candyman. So there's a little bit of confusion over who is the Candyman. But a lot of the parents of the victims of Dean Corll, and certainly people in the Heights neighborhood, thought of him and his mother as the candy shop owners, the candy man. He actually made and delivered candy himself. And there are stories of victims who say they use that candy. He used that candy as a way to kind of lure kids and befriend people.
It does seem to me that you also are trying to steer away from some of the most voyeuristic elements of this story.
Yes, I'm trying to get people to refocus on really the human rights issue, which is, you know, in counties across Texas and across the United States, we have this sort of unseen epidemic of unidentified people. And these are the stories of eight of them in this book. There are many, many more. In Houston alone, we still have 300 or so unidentified. There are thousands of unidentified persons in Texas and some 40,000 across the country. It's really a big problem. And I think a lot of us think, well, gee, that should be solved. You know, we have DNA. We have forensic genetic genealogy where people can even match DNA samples to, you know, someone's family, someone's distant cousin, and figure out who they are. Why do we still have this in America? And the truth is that there's just really not enough resources for these cases. And the result is that there are many families like these Texas families whose stories I tell in this book who remain in this sort of limbo where they don't know if their family member who's missing is alive or dead. They can't have a funeral. They don't really have memorial services available to them. They don't have answers until those identifications are made. And of course, in this case, even though there were two people prosecuted, as I said, one in a big trial that got a lot of publicity there in San Antonio, and two people went to prison, the truth is that there were likely additional accomplices that were never prosecuted. And, you know, in this case and others, the fact that murder victims go unidentified sometimes means that really important clues that could lead to additional revelations in a case never come to light, and then police don't find that additional information. So there's no answers for the family, and additional leads that might point to other killers or additional accomplices go uninvestigated. So I'm trying to get people to focus on that issue. I feel like a lot of our true crime stories They're focused on the killers. They're focused sometimes on the forensic science. And of course, forensic science is at the center of this book. I do tell you about those advances.
Okay, but so I got to take a break here. We're going to come back. We're going to continue talking with Lisa Olson about her book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. If you want to call in, 833-877-8255. Jennifer, I'm going to get you on the air as soon as we come back from this break. The Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Between 1970 and 73, Dean Corll, infamously known as the Candyman, along with his accomplices David Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley, they were responsible for the abduction and murder of at least 28 young men in the Houston area. And many of these men, there are a number of them that are still unidentified, and we're talking to the investigative journalist Lisa Olson about that. She's written a book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Jennifer. And Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I do recall the original trial. And to me, forensic science has moved way forward. And we, you know, it's just amazing to me that we cannot recall and cannot investigate these poor families who are left hanging after all these many years.
Jennifer, thank you for the call, and thanks for making that point. So, Lisa, I think you used the term frozen grief in your book.
Yes, there is this concept in psychology called frozen grief. It's associated with people whose family members are, you know, missing in action or prisoners of war, people who don't get the actual confirmation through remains or DNA that other people do. And it creates a lasting, longer grief process that's more protracted. And I think a lot of us know how painful grief is from real life experience. But imagine if you didn't know for sure if your family member was alive or dead, if you didn't know for sure whether you should keep hoping or whether you should move on, whether you should hold a service or not. And a lot of these people, when I reached out to them, and I reached out to siblings, and there are a few parents left, and to best friends and former girlfriends, people whose lives were forever changed by these murders. And they describe a kind of a loss that is incredibly fresh and raw despite the passage of time. And that's associated with this sort of concept of frozen grief. And it's a very painful thing. And I relate to what the caller said, that I feel like what we need is more attention on these cases and a little bit more investment. I think one of the things that I talk about in this book is how answers were provided to six families, and there's two more waiting for confirmation, final confirmation, a total of eight cases that Sharon Derrick worked on in this process, where families did get answers and how that did help them move on. And what I'm kind of trying to show in this book that, you know, it is possible, even in these very old cases, to move forward and to provide answers to people. And it really doesn't take that much investment. It just takes, sometimes it just takes one forensic scientist to really care about it, as in this case. But I do think these cases are really important, and this is a bigger human rights issue.
So interesting thing about, you know, exploring that time period, 1970 to 73, it was like a different planet at that time. You know, no cell phones, digital stuff did not exist. It was easier to get lost in the world. There was so much going on in the United States. People were joining these cults. They were running away to California. There was a lot of that going on. And so when these parents went to the Houston Police Department, they didn't even have a missing persons department at that time in Houston. Their police department, I would definitely call it dysfunctional. They would just say that off the cuff without any kind of evidence or even a superficial investigation. As you point out in the book, some of these young men who went missing, if they were going to run away, you would think that they would have taken their prized Mustang or picked up their last paycheck or done other things. Just a cursory examination of what was happening would have made you doubt that this was a runaway.
Absolutely. I mean, today, obviously, we have things like, sex offender registries, Amber Alerts. The Amber Alert is named for Amber Hagerman, a young girl from Texas who was abducted, whose murder remains unsolved. But back in the 70s, there were kids running away. There still are today, kids who are become estranged from their parents. But if you look at the individual facts of these missing persons, time after time, you do find things like, why did Steve Sickman leave his Mustang parked on the street if he, quote, ran away? Why did Frank Aguirre leave his girlfriend behind and his last paycheck and not go to his high school graduation, which was just a few weeks beyond the time he disappeared? You know, why did two boys who were walking together to a pool both disappear when one of them was a little boy who was packed and ready to go on a hill country vacation with his family and really excited about that trip? You know, and the kind of crazier thing when you think about today's policing and how, of course, these kinds of things can be mapped if police do notice, you know, that there are patterns in what we would now call endangered missing persons, people who seem too young or they're very big red flags and seem more likely to be murder victims. They would have been able to see there were a cluster of these disappearances in a fairly small area. A lot of these kids knew each other. Some of them went to the same junior high school, Hamilton Junior High in Houston. And so there were patterns, but they weren't being seen by police. But as you say, it was also a very different time. These parents did almost universally report these kids missing to police. They did call. But they were those efforts to report the missing were taken usually 48 hours after the person was missing. Reports wouldn't be taken before then. Some of the families didn't have home phones. There really weren't a lot of answering machines at the time. You know, the state of the art was a huge, cell phone that actually was a car phone that famously one of the reporters who covered this case had, and it was enormous. It looked like a small suitcase. No one had that kind of technology other than maybe people who worked for NASA and a few doctors at the medical center might have had very primitive beepers, but ordinary people didn't have a good way to stay in touch. The kids who were staying out with their friends might have to go find a payphone working, you know, and grab the right change to try to call their parents who may or may not answer the phone. And so that uncertainty about where kids were did kind of go both ways. The parents weren't able to blow the whistle right away in some cases. And when they did, the police often just said, hey, you know, a lot of kids are hitchhiking these days. A lot of kids were worrying about the Vietnam War. You know, some kids were moving away to California or joining cults, like you said. This was sort of still the kind of heyday of the hippie movement. So the police used that as a way to kind of say, hey, you know, we don't really need to pay attention to most of these missing persons. But again, even in these cursory reports that were being written down, there were a lot of red flags.
Was there ever any kind of apology or acceptance that the Houston Police Department failed?
No, kind of amazingly, in 1973, Houston had a very, very different police department than it does today. The chief was a guy named Herman Short, who was a segregationist, who called out armed officers who opened fire on students at a university during an anti-war protest. He was rumored to have ties to the Ku Klux Klan. He was a completely different kind of chief. He blamed in a speech, in a press conference right after these murders were discovered, and the three burial sites, all clandestine burial grave sites, that were in different parts of Texas, in Houston, on High Island, and in East Texas, in the woods near a cabin that Coral's family owned. These generated huge amounts of publicity, and people from as far away as Italy, the Pope, and the Russian government, Izvestia, sent these messages condemning the police for not paying attention to these missing kids and for their apparent indifference. So Police Chief Short calls this press conference, packed room at City Hall, and he essentially attacks the parents and says it's their fault for not paying more attention to their kids, as if a predatory, very organized serial killer pedophile had not spirited them away and abducted them in a very organized, sophisticated fashion. He really accepted no blame and offered no apologies, and quite the reverse. He went on the attack.
So to take the idea that the book is centered around is that we should be investing in figuring out who these individuals who died, who were the victims. Now, police departments and prosecutors, they're concerned about, you know, getting arrest and making collars and putting people in prison. But Dean Corll, he was dead by the time he was, you know, killed. By the time they found out that this whole thing was going on, it was a case closed for them. It didn't, as far as they were concerned, these officers, the establishment, it wasn't worth it to invest in finding out how many more victims there were, because the guy was already dead. But, you know, here's the police department of Houston, which failed these children. That means that the city failed them. The city owes them a debt to invest and figure this out.
I think you're right. You know, and beyond that, society, I think, owes the unidentified and the missing, you know, the right to their identities. You know, we could invest a little bit more in these kinds of cases and get a lot of answers fairly quickly. And there are other cases where there are killers at large because of the lack of identifications. It's just a huge roadblock for officers. So I want to say, you know, there were certainly police officers who were trying their best once these murders were exposed. I mean, one of the officers who worked for HPD was the cousin of one of the murder victims. He worked very hard to try to track Dean Corll's every known prior location to try to figure out who Corll might have killed that wasn't being identified. The ME's office at the time in Harris County was one of the best in the country. It was led by a kind of a legendary medical examiner named Dr. Joe Jehimchek.
Oh, he was the first in Texas.
Yes. Who, you know, later became a consultant for Earl Standing Gardner. He worked with a forensic dentist, who, Dr. Stimson, who was really ahead of his time in terms of using dental records to confirm identification. So they were really working hard, but they obviously needed the names of missing persons. They needed dental records from family members to confirm IDs. And what happened in Houston, if you think back to those times, is, you know, Houston, like I said, had this regressive police chief. It was about, though, to change. Houston was about to elect a new mayor. But the administration at that time, both at the county and city level, they sort of had the attitude, we've got Corll's dead. We've got his two teen accomplices. They led us to the bodies. We can make those cases against them with the bodies we have identified. We don't need to identify every last bone, and it would be really difficult, right? And the other thing was the investigation behind the scenes that those officers were pursuing, both Houston police and Pasadena, Texas police, who really deserve a lot of credit, because Corll himself was killed in the Houston suburb, the next town over of Pasadena. And so Pasadena PD actually did an amazing, a lot of work after Corll's death to try to help identify these victims and follow up on these cases that were abductions and kidnappings and murders that mostly happened in Houston. And so, you know, there was an effort by police going on to continue to investigate, but on the county and city level, there was a very strong message being sent that we want to move on. Houston doesn't want to be known as Murder City. You know, we can leave that to Austin, where they had the tower shootings, right? Or to Dallas, where JFK was assassinated. Houston wants to be Space City. We've got these two guys in prison already. Let's move on. So, you know, if you look back, and we all know these days that it takes a while to investigate a murder case, particularly a murder where in 1973, they knew there were 27 victims. As I reveal in my book, there were definitely at least 30, according to forensic evidence, and there likely are more. But police had the evidence they need to make those cases, DA has had enough evidence to make those cases, then they went, there was a lot of pressure to move on. So within a matter of 4 months, the hearing begins on Elmer Wayne Henley, the first defendant in these cases in Houston. Then the venues changed to San Antonio. But a year after these murders are discovered, the whole thing is closed. You know, the case is closed, defendants are in prison, and everybody wants to move on. The leads that were
I got to take a break here. We're going to talk more about this. We're going to talk more about Dean Corll, how he operated, and lessons that can be learned about this case. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've got a question or a comment, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. It focuses on the Candyman serial killing of 1970 to 1973. We're joined by the author, Lisa Olson. And you can call in with a question or comment, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So when we talked about how it was a different world back then, we've seen the investigation. You can go on YouTube and you can see the news clips of how the police were excavating the crime scene or the boathouse, the boat shed. And it's just, it's unbelievable that it was basically everyone was walking all over the crime scene, just stomping all over everything with shovels and a backhoe. But there's this incredible scene there, Lisa, and I'm sure I know you know all about this, with where the accused or the accomplice Elmer Wayne Henley, he is able to go to one of the news channel cars, and as you talked about, they had a cell phone of some sort, and he called his mother.
Mama.
Who's this?
It's Wayne.
Yes, this is Mama, baby.
Mama.
Yeah.
I killed Dean.
Wayne.
So what happened there? Lisa, how is it that Elmer Wayne Henley, he killed Dean? This is a scene, opening chapter of the book. You really lay it all out, and it's gripping that Dean, who was going to pull his torture and murder, you know, routine on his accomplice, and they turned tables on him.
That's right. As I said, Dean Corll was someone that today we would call an organized serial killer.
He like was a Dexter. Guy who had,
yeah, yeah. He was a guy who had a torture board equipped with ropes and handcuffs at the ready to immobilize one or two victims at a time that he kept in a back room where he had like a plastic sheet on the floor below that floorboard so that he could do whatever he wanted on those boards and bodily fluids could drip down. I don't want to get too graphic, but he was a horrible person. He had a toolbox full of implements he used to torture people. He was an electrician, so the toolbox, you know, kind of fit in with his outwardly normal persona. He cultivated these really bizarre relationships. We would now say groomed these teenagers, two teenagers, one of whom he met when he was only 10 years old, and paid them money, gave them sexual favors, gave them drugs to coerce them into helping him. So he had this whole system set out. He also had body boxes where he could hide the corpses once he killed people.
And he was also taking photographs and selling photographs.
Absolutely, absolutely. We can get into that too. But the night in question of Corll's death, a lot of times how he lured kids to his party, his house, was under the sort of guise of a party. Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., who liked to be called Wayne, invited two friends to a party at Corll's house in August 1973. And on that particular night, certainly I think sometimes Wayne absolutely knew that the kids he was inviting to the parties were going to be killed, tortured, and buried in these clandestine burial sites. But that night, he claims he didn't know Coral was ready to hunt and kill people. I think you could raise doubts about that, because I think Coral had already talked about how interested he was in Wayne's friend, Tim Curley. So Wayne that night brings over his friend Tim, and Wayne brings his girlfriend. Coral's initially asleep. He works as an electrician at that time. He by then left his candy shops and was working as an electrician. And Wayne and his friends start to party, get high, and then in the morning, Coral ties them up before they're really awake, before they're really coherent, and begins to do his thing. But this time, Wayne is going to be part of one of the victims.
So that Dean is mad because, mm-hmm. or Coral is mad because Wayne brought a girl.
Well, that's what Henley says later. He says Coral's mad at him because he brought a girl over. And Coral, of course, only liked boys or young men of a certain age range. The victims were all pretty much 13 to their 20 or 21. And so Coral gets angry. This time, you know, potentially Wayne is going to be one of the victims. Wayne argues his way out of the ropes that are binding him, out of the handcuffs, and he pretends he's going to help Coral one more time. But at some point during this whole process of watching Coral go through his routine, and I won't get too graphic on the radio what that routine is, but you can imagine, Wayne grabs a gun that Coral's kept on a dresser in that same room where the torture board is located, and he starts to shoot Dean. Dean taunts him and says, you're not going to do it, Wayne, and Wayne kills him. Wayne breaks and kills Dean Coral, and that's what causes a manslaughter or murder is what prompts this whole thing to be exposed. And the fact that Elmer Wayne Henley, when he's arrested by Pasadena police and goes down to see a really legendary homicide detective at Pasadena police, Wayne Henley begins to talk. He begins to talk about the horrors he's seen being essentially Dean Coral's apprentice or henchman. And that's how the police find out about the murders and find out about the boat shed. And eventually Henley leads them to other grave sites, as does David Brooks. David Brooks, like I said, had met Dean Coral when he was only 10 years old. He initially is not cooperating with police, but after Henley starts to talk, David Brooks comes in and also starts to offer information, and the search expands. But absolutely, the search at the boat shed is complete chaos. Wayne Henley is there the whole time, standing outside. Reporters are swarming him, asking for interviews. He does that phone call you just heard. Inside the boat shed, all kinds of dignitaries who aren't even involved in the case are trooping through, kind of getting a tour. I've heard mayors of different cities, police chiefs and officials from other departments come in because they want to look at this. Everywhere in that boat shed are footprints, are people. The people actually doing the digging are trustees brought from Harris County Jail, sprung to start digging. And of course, they began to find one grave after another. Approximately half of the victims were buried there, and one on top of the other, sometimes two in one grave, and most of them were bones, and sometimes those bones were mixed together. And the whole way they're excavated has nothing in common with what you might see on a CSI show today, or you could go on YouTube and see an FBI exercise of how to do this at one of the body farms around the country. Nothing like that happened. There was no search grid. There were no really precise measurements taken of where the graves were. The bones that start to arrive at the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office, which in that days was housed in the basement of the county hospital, some of them are incomplete sets of remains. There's bones missing. Some of the sets of remains zipped into body bags have additional bones that don't belong to the victims. And that's the kind of puzzle that the ME's office begins to inherit, is they get all these sets of remains that aren't very well excavated, aren't very well marked, and then they start to get hundreds of reports of missing persons who these remains could belong to. It's a real problem for the ME's office. And And there's absolutely a mess at the search site. The other thing Henley starts to blurt out to reporters and to police is, once the boat shed's searched in a remarkably small, short amount of time, there's less than 2 full days of searching, they move on to the next site, is Henley says, you know what, there's other bodies left there, there's more. And they just move on. They go on then to a beach, and they go on to the woods.
So let me put a pin in that and ask you this. So right now, there could be bodies still buried at that boat shed, but it's privately owned, and so there's no way to actually look for them.
There are very likely additional bones at that boat shed. There aren't probably any bodies per se, but there are certainly...
Yeah, I mean, remains.
Yes, there's certainly likely additional bones. In fact, as I reveal in the book, we absolutely know that... It's very, very likely that the rest of one of two murder victims whose identities I reveal in the book, that the rest of his bones are still at that boat shed. Absolutely.
And some parents, they were given remains that may not have been the actual person they were looking for. They may have been mix-ups.
There were absolutely also mix-ups, even though, like I said, the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office was the first one in the state and was using the best technology available in 1973. There was a lot of emotional pressure to identify, in particular, the victims who were named by Brooks and Henley, because Brooks and Henley went to Hamilton Junior High School in the Heights. They knew the names of some of the boys Coral had killed. And they started to deliver those names and some descriptions. And so the parents of the kids who were named were absolutely frantic. Some of them were camping at the ME's office, demanding answers. There were two sets of brothers. And both of those sets of brothers, unfortunately, the families were relatively poor. One of the families had moved around a lot, and they did not have immediate access to their dental records. The boys had last seen a dentist in Florida. The father worked in construction, and he was in Houston to work on a high rise, very near where his boys were abducted and killed.
Right. Jerry and Donald Waldrop.
That's right.
13 and there were 15.
Exactly. And there were two other brothers, Michael and Billy Balch, also similar ages.
Can you imagine being 15
and
those
17
parents?
Yeah.
Having to deal with all that.
It was horrifying.
I got to take a break. I'm so sorry. Listen, Randall, I see you on the board. I'll get you on the air when we come back from the break. 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're having a conversation with investigative journalist Lisa Olson. She's also an editor at the Texas Observer. She's, you know, one of the stellar investigative reporters of Texas. Her new book is The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. Our number is 833-877-8255. And Randall, let's get Randall on the air. Randall, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Ms. Olson, thanks for all of the fascinating information and so forth. I'm listening to all of this, which is news to me because I was in kindergarten and grade school when all of this was happening. But I can't help, and I can't be the only person out there drawing comparisons between these Houston Candyman cases. And then just a few years later, a very similar rash of killings in Atlanta, Georgia. To your knowledge, Ms. Olson, what impact did any of the Candyman cases have on...
Okay, we lost them, but, you know, so Lisa Olson, was this case, you know, the Coral case, did this have an impact across the nation? Did this inform other police departments? Did this make them better prepared to catch other people like Coral?
There are two answers to that question I'd like to give. One is that absolutely, I think it was kind of a wake-up call to police all across the country, both about the stealthy nature of sexual predators and the weakness of laws that would protect young male victims of sex crimes. Because a lot of these kids, you know, there were surviving victims too who had not come forward because of the kind of stigma surrounding these crimes. But the other thing was, you know, the FBI subsequently does develop its serial killer interview methods, and gradually police become more and more aware of the phenomenon of serial killers. But on the flip side, it's known that one of the people who read the articles about Dean Corll was another serial killer you've probably heard of, from Chicago, John Wayne Gacy, who also used similar methods to immobilize his victims, including offering them handcuffs and saying, "Hey, I know a trick where you can get out of handcuffs, put these on and I'll show you." And that was the way he was able to immobilize younger boys and men who otherwise might have been able to fight back. Corll did the same thing. The thing that is not really well known about Dean Corll, even in Houston, among people who really remember this case, is that he was not only a sexual predator, but he was, as you mentioned earlier, David, part of a ring who was taking erotic or pornographic pictures of young men and boys. In some of his parties, he had men, other men in the back rooms, taking pictures, performing sex acts, filming them. He was part of a porn ring that distributed photos and videos internationally. That was not disclosed at the time these murders went global. That was kept secret. There was evidence about that at the time that was not discussed openly. There was more evidence that came to light later. And a few years later, police made an arrest of a Houston music producer who had tons of porn in multiple locations, including a hotel in the Houston Heights and in a warehouse. And in all that were photos of lots and lots of Houston boys and young men, including 11 of the murder victims. That was really kept under wraps. So the idea that the sexual predators could also be homicidal serial killers was something that, unfortunately, Dean Corll was a pioneer in. And at the time, there was an opportunity lost, I think, to learn a lot more about these crimes and to save a lot more lives if the investigation had immediately continued and if police had been more forthcoming about that.
That I'm going to go to a caller. We have Roy here. And Roy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for this program that's today. I remember I lived on 21st and Couch Street when a boy was actually abducted somewhere in my neighborhood. And I went to Hamilton Junior High. So this is just driving a lot of memories. And it brings back the fear and everything else, because I was playing outside the day one of those boys was kidnapped in my neighborhood. And so it's just.
Roy, did you have any idea at the time that there was something going on? Did y'all know? You know, we know how kids know things on the street. Did you know that there was something going on?
Not until after. My dad loves the news, and so I remember just seeing it on the news. But no, I didn't know, or I don't believe I knew the boys personally. But I know that I, playing outside in the evening time with other kids and stuff, seized for us.
Did it have an impact on the neighborhood? Did things change when people found out about this?
I don't believe that a lot of things changed, other than we more or less just watched out for each other. That the things that I remember really changing is that we didn't hang outside, we didn't go anywheres. After dark, especially. And so, but I just don't remember any other changes of that nature.
Well, Roy, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it. You helped us understand a little bit better about what happened there. Any reaction, Lisa Olson?
So there's a whole generation of people who lost, you know, friends and family. And part of my book is kind of creating the lost world of these lost boys, the boys who are identified by Sharon Derrick, the voice whose names were not published in 1973, and honoring their memories. And a lot of stories like the one you just heard are in my book, but with a lot of very vivid details about the boys who were actually killed. One of them in particular, I remember, is I was the cover of the book, which is on sale now anywhere you want to get it, and I'll be at the San Antonio Book Festival talking about it soon, comes from an evening when I was sitting in a Heights restaurant with a woman who was the high school or junior high school girlfriend of Michael Balch, one of the two brothers who was murdered, two sets of brothers. And the last time she saw him was at a restaurant, a coffee shop on that same block where I took the photo that's on the cover. And Michael came in, and certainly Nita, his former girlfriend, knew that some kids their age were missing, including classmates. She knew Michael's brother, Billy, was missing. And they started talking, and Michael said cryptically, "I know who did something to my brother. I know who took them, and I'm going to do something about it." That was the last time she ever saw him alive, and he disappeared. But that's the kind of ominous story that a lot of teens shared with me. It wasn't enough at the time for them to go to police, and many of them didn't trust police. A lot of them were kind of hippies who felt like the police were sort of the enemy in Houston. I mean, I talked to you about what the department was like. A lot of kids were being hassled. Other kids, even kids who had, you know, no hippie ties, were feared that the police would just beat them up or arrest them if they tried to report any crimes. But there were a lot of kids seeing things that they didn't understand. Seeing friends disappear, they didn't understand that why they were where they were going. Seeing friends who were supposedly labeled as runaways, who they didn't believe had run away, knowing that more than one kid in their class had disappeared. Some of these kids also had gone to parties at Dean Quarles' house and seen weird things that they didn't understand. And a few of them had been approached or even chased by Dean Quarles. And there's stories that they share in my book that are really just absolutely chilling. And the atmosphere, though, at the time with that police department as it was just not one where police, where teens thought they would be believed. They thought they would be blamed. And unfortunately, that mindset sometimes still continues today. The idea that especially a victim of an attempted sex crime is very reluctant to go forward because they don't believe they're going to be believed. Still today. And that's one of the reasons why I think these stories are so important. A lot of these kids who were chased, whether or not they were actually assaulted, didn't think the police would believe them.
So one listener writes in, will cuts, budget cuts, was that going to impact future investigations or work like Sharon Derrick did?
When George W. Bush was president, the Texan, you know, he funded the Federal Department of Justice funded grants to work on cold cases. He was very aware of this because of the issues related to 9/11, all the unidentified people killed in the terrorist attack. Since then, there has been no federal money dedicated to this. This is something you can help influence as individuals. This is not a partisan issue. This is a human rights issue. These people deserve answers. These people, we all deserve answers, and we deserve the justice. There should be 40,000 people in America who remain unidentified without names. That should be the case.
How many victims do you think that Dean Quarles had?
Well, I reveal the names of, there are six that have already been announced in the 2010s that are new victims. I tell you their life stories in this book. There are two more I announce in the book. So there are at least 30 that are absolutely confirmed. There are three additional missing persons who have links. They either live near Quarles or Quarles and Brooks. They went to school with some of the other victims. They were last seen. One of them was last seen with Elmer Wayne Henley. That are believed to be endangered missing persons related to this case. So I guess the true number is somewhere between 35 and 40.
It's hard to believe that he just started in 1970 just doing this. So, I mean, the number is probably even more than that. But, you know, we need evidence, and you found evidence. You make news. You really did the hard work, Lisa Olson. The book is The Scientist and the Serial Killer, The Search for Houston's Lost Boys. Lisa, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks, and there's an excerpt running tomorrow in the Texas Observer if you want a preview.
All right. Lisa Olson, thank you so much. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.